From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we'll be discussing a growing trend in American agriculture, the factory farm. In this type of farm, industrial techniques of mass production are used to raise and harvest animals for mass markets across the country. Unfortunately, there are many adverse consequences of this type of agriculture on the environment, the animals themselves, and the public health for both consumers and communities adjacent to these operations. Our guests today, Dave Willinga and Karen Hudson, will describe these facilities, the adverse impacts they cause, and the efforts of communities, government, and consumers to limit the harm that can accompany these operations. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Earlier this month, the U.S. Senate voted to abolish a rule imposed by President Bush called the Global Gag Rule. The president imposed the rule the first full day he was in office in January 2001 to prevent international family planning organizations that receive U.S. aid from performing or even discussing abortion. 8 Republicans in the Senate joined all the Democrats to achieve a 52-46 vote to abolish the gag rule. During the debate on the bill, Barbara Boxer gave several examples of organizations that have had to cut services rather than submit to the gag rule. One such example was a clinic in Nepal, which refused to abide by the gag rule when it lobbied the government of Nepal, pushing for a change in the law that imprisoned a 13-year-old for getting an abortion after being raped by her uncle. Observers of the political situation in Washington predicted that the House would not go along with the Senate action, and therefore the gag rule will remain in effect. The Baltimore Sun recently published a profile of Kevin Dowling, a Roman Catholic bishop who ministers in a mining region west of Pretoria in South Africa. Despite pressure and rebukes from the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, which opposes all forms of contraception, Dowling has taken an open position in support of condom use to prevent transmission of HIV infection. Dowling criticized the church for being out of touch with the magnitude of the HIV crisis in Africa and insists that his position is strongly pro-life since its goal is to prevent transmission of a lethal infection. The Catholic Church has opened an AIDS hospice in Dowling's parish, where on average a death occurs every other day. The church also runs an AIDS clinic in a squatter's camp in the parish, where 300 people are receiving antiretroviral medication. Dowling has also started several businesses for women in his parish, hoping that the money they earn through the business ventures would prevent HIV infection by reducing the women's need to resort to prostitution to support their families. The profile of Dowling is available through the Baltimore Sun's website, baltimoresun.com. Another item related to the HIV epidemic, the government of Great Britain has pledged the equivalent of $45 million to fund trials for a gel that can prevent women from being infected by the HIV virus, which leads to AIDS. The field trials are to be carried out by the Medical Research Council of England and Imperial College of London and are expected to begin by the end of this summer and run for approximately 3.5 years. More than 10,000 women in South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zambia are expected to take part in the research. If the gel proves to be safe and effective in preventing the sexual transmission of HIV infection, it would represent a major breakthrough in the battle against the HIV pandemic, due to the limitations of available strategies to prevent the sexual transmission of the virus. During the week of this show's broadcast, the Vermont House of Representatives will begin consideration of a bill to provide a system of universal health care in the state of Vermont. The bill proposes to use broad-based taxation to create a state insurance fund that would provide comprehensive health insurance coverage for all residents of the state. Since everyone in the state would be contributing to the fund through taxation, the bill effectively bypasses the need for private health insurance for covered services. If such a system were enacted, Vermont would become the first state government to opt for a universal health care system. For listeners who would like to learn more about universal health care systems, check out the Public Health Radio website, publichealthradio.org, where several shows have covered the issue, including explorations of the healthcare systems of France and Canada. Those wishing to read the Vermont bill, and for Vermonters wishing to send comments or letters of support to their legislators, may go to the website of the Vermont Legislature, where you should look for Bill H-524. The web address is leg.state.vt.us. On upcoming shows, we'll keep you informed about progress on the struggle for universal health care in Vermont and elsewhere in the U.S. Coming up next, a look at factory farms. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, we'll be looking at an important trend in American agriculture that has been occurring over the last 20 years. The growth of concentrated animal feeding operations, otherwise known as factory farms. This new agricultural approach has impacts on the economics of agriculture, the farm environment, the health of communities surrounding the farms, those drinking water downstream from these farms, and on those who consume the meat and dairy products that come from these farms. And there are even impacts on medical care in terms of trends in asthma and in the growing problem of antibiotic resistance among bacteria that cause human infections. Joining us today to discuss factory farming are Karen Hudson and Dave Walinga. Karen Hudson is a consultant for the Grace Factory Farm Campaign. She lives on a fifth-generation family farm in central Illinois and is president of FARM, a grassroots organization in Illinois that provides research and technical assistance to communities impacted by agricultural techniques that are a threat to public health. Dave Walinga is a medical doctor and senior scientist at the Minnesota-based Institute for Agricultural and Trade Policy. There, he is project director for a major effort exploring the relationship between agricultural antibiotic use and the growing problem of antibiotic resistance in medicine. He has served as a consultant to the World Bank and the World Health Organization and has authored several articles and books that evaluate the impacts of pesticides and other environmental toxins on child development. Karen Hudson and Dave Walinga, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here, I live in Vermont, and here in Vermont, we have a certain notion of what a farm is. And I think it would include looking at a pasture that has cows. And I have to tell you, I have several patients in my medical practice who are farmers, and they can actually tell me about each cow, strategies to get the cow to go from one place to another, to bring it inside when they want it to. And they start to know their animals and they know their personalities. They have a good sense of their physical needs. This notion, which I think people in Vermont at least have, and I suspect it's not just here, of what a farm is something very different from what I've been reading about in terms of factory farms. So before we talk about the public health implications of what a factory farm is, I guess I'd like to understand what this other type of farming involves.
The animals, whether it be dairy cattle or swine, poultry, are kept, large numbers of animals are kept concentrated on small areas of land. Most of the time the animals are inside and spend their entire lives inside under artificial light and either on a hard surface or a slatted floor where their waste drops through. So it's a very different look than what would someone would look at as a traditional family farm where animals are allowed to graze on the land and act normally.
Because they're indoors, they're producing emissions that are more like a factory emission. There are air emissions that are carrying byproducts of degrading manure and urine out of the building. There is an indoor factory-like environment that has a lot of impacts on the people that work in these facilities. And then there's water emissions, because when you concentrate literally thousands, or in the case of poultry, hundreds of thousands of animals in one area, you're just generating an incredible amount of manure. And much of it gets liquefied and can then pollute the water either underneath the facility, like groundwater, or rivers or streams next to the facility.
Inside of factory farms, we notice many differences in the way animals are treated as compared to farms where animals are allowed to graze or be allowed on pasture. The hogs had their tails cut off because swine in confinement will bite each other's tails and they'll cannibalize each other. There's a high amount of stress within the animal population in a factory farm compared to a free-range or pasture-raised farm. This eventually leads to stresses on the immune system, which produces higher amounts of illness among the animals. The concentrations of animals in these facilities also cause the animals to be exposed to their own manure and ammonia emissions and other emissions. So just as workers and neighbors are feeling the effects from these, the animals also feel the effects from their own emissions. In fact, 80% of pigs have pneumonia upon slaughter. So when hogs are taken to market, the mere fact that such a high percentage of them are already sick points to the fact that this is not a natural way to raise the animals.
I was also reading from some of the descriptions of these farms that poultry farms, it would be typical to amputate their beaks. Is that also the case?
Yes, they debeak poultry in poultry animal feeding operations, and they debeak ducks. And
you're using the term debeak.
Debeak.
As if this is some sort of normal action that one would think about in normal human activity.
Yes.
You're saying that they physically remove the beak from these animals, and I assume this is not done with any kind of anesthesia.
No, they remove part of the beak from the animals. And there are many nerve endings that are exposed to that area, which common sense says that they are going to be feeling the after effects from this, you know, during the debeaking process and possibly effects after it's been performed.
And the motive for doing that?
It's to keep the animals from cannibalizing each other and pecking on each other, pecking their feathers out, because they're in such tight, confined quarters.
So the implication is that if the animals could walk around outdoors under normal, I'm calling it normal, under such circumstances that what we're used to thinking about animals' lives, they wouldn't normally cannibalize each other.
Exactly. In large-scale swine feeding operations, for example, swine that are held in gestational crates, these crates where they can't even turn around. There's very little room to move. They can only stand up or sit down. They start to bang their heads against the bars. This kind of behavior actually helps them cope with their tightly confined quarters. So you'll see animals that are banging their heads or doing repetitive motions of their mouth on the bars. They think that this releases endorphins in the animal's brain that helps them cope with this type of unnatural confinement.
I just want to mention a couple of things that I think makes these kinds of farms or facilities quite different from what we have thought about as farms in the past. One is that in many cases, great pains are taken to keep them out of the public view so that one can really only appreciate their scope from an airplane. They're placed either far from roads or, behind trees or other barriers so that people can't see them. Some states have actually passed laws that make it criminal to take pictures of some of these facilities. And so the public really doesn't see them in the same way that we used to see farms. What we often get as an impression is a smell. So if you drive down a interstate freeway between Karen's house and my house, you'll drive through an area with a lot of intensive hog production and smell it from the freeway.
Is this type of farming becoming more common, or is this increasing or decreasing in prevalence?
This kind of farming, if you will, or factory production, really describes how the vast majority of the meat and dairy products are produced in the country now. And it's only becoming more prevalent. I have a little statistic here. Just 5% of U.S. farms now account for 54% or more of the beef and dairy cattle, the pigs and the poultry that we produce in the U.S.
And that 5% of farms represent the factory farms?
Represents the biggest of the factory farms. But in general, I'd say that what you're seeing as a trend is that the biggest of the farms keep getting bigger and keep producing a bigger slice of the meat and dairy products in the country.
Do either of you know if this type of farming is unique to the United States, or is this going on internationally also?
It's going on internationally, and one country that employed these methods was the Netherlands, and they are experiencing such an overload of phosphorus that they're heavily taxing any type of dairy expansion in that country. And now we're seeing Dutch dairy farmers moving into several Midwestern states, such as Ohio, Michigan, and Indiana, on an attempt to sell out all their property back in the Netherlands and moving over to the United States, where the regulatory hoops are very easy to jump through.
Some of the companies that are producing the most animal, they're planning to move overseas. And that's already happened in Mexico and then throughout Central America. It's happened with Smithfield, which is a huge hog producer, for example, moving very aggressively into Poland so that they can serve the European market.
A few years ago, I traveled to Poland to speak with family hog farmers in that country, and their message to us in the United States was, we have seen what has happened in the United States with factory farms and the impacts on neighbors and health and animals and farmers, and we do not want these facilities in our country. We toured family-owned packing plants that were meticulously clean, just fearing for their future with the plans that Smithfield had to come into their country. And Smithfield would like to see these small packing plants closed down, which is what they're doing right now, and putting factory farms in Poland. And as we speak, Poland has some very severe environmental and health impacts from factory farms in the last few years where Smithfield has integrated into that country.
Are most factory farms owned by a very small number of large corporations, or what is the corporate profile here?
Certainly there are some very large companies that are controlling a larger and larger slice of the food production that occurs in these facilities, whether it's through contracts, which can be quite coercive with the actual producers, or whether it's through direct ownership of the farms.
One of the things listeners may not understand when we talk about contracts is a farmer will sign a contract for a company such as Smithfield or Tyson, and they are responsible for raising the animals. The farmer, however, is responsible for all the waste produced. The farmer, however, is responsible for any animals that die and their disposal. So in essence, these companies have a great deal. They have a farmer who's willing to sign a contract, put his money on the line to take care of these animals, and yet when it comes to any type of a disaster that may happen with a manure spill, a high death rate, the farmer carries all of the responsibility. So in essence, it's a contract that's very much in the corporation's favor.
And I assume the farmer feels his or her back against the wall, otherwise they probably wouldn't sign that type of contract, I'd have to assume.
Very much so.
Now, I'd like to turn now to the impact of these farms on public health, and maybe we could start off by discussing the impacts of factory farms on the local environment. I guess the obvious place to start is with animal waste. You mentioned about the production of huge amounts of manure on these, when there's thousands and thousands of animals in one spot. And I guess I'm used to, again, the farmers I interact with, family farmers here in Vermont, for them, manure is an asset. They get manure, and they spread it out in the soil where they're going to be growing crops, and that adds nitrogen to the soil, and that's a good thing. But here it seems like it's not a good thing, and manure in this situation is a problem rather than an asset.
In low amounts, manure can provide some nutrients to crops or to soils like nitrogen and phosphorus. But when you've got the huge amounts of manure, you're really overwhelming the ability of the soil or the land to absorb that manure. And the larger the factory farm, the more likely it is that the manure that's produced is just going to completely overwhelm the capacity of that land. So you get things like algae blooms in the waters adjacent to farms that are severe enough to kill fish or to make the water uninhabitable for fish, just because the manure running off from the farm is overwhelming the oxygen supply in the water. And similarly, you're having excess phosphorus and nitrogen that's having impacts far beyond the farm downstream.
Well, one of the byproducts of fermenting manure in an anaerobic system, such as a pit or a lagoon, this is a way they store the waste. It's minimally treated, and most of the gases go into the air, especially nitrogen is volatilized out of a lagoon. But what they do is spread this waste from the lagoon. They'll pump it out of these very large, sometimes football field size holes in the ground, or else they will pump it from a pit underneath a building where many thousands of hogs are, for example, if you're talking about the swine sector. One of the gases produced by the decomposition of this waste is hydrogen sulfide, and it's a very potent neurotoxin, and it's been proven that even low ambient levels of this gas can cause permanent neurological damage to humans. It's a very insidious gas. It travels quite a distance from a facility in a plume, and the effects of that can go anywhere from headaches to blacking out. We've had citizens who have vomited, blacked out. There's a lawsuit right now alleging that 17 people in the state of Ohio have suffered brain damage from these from a particular facility. I've met one of these individuals, talks with a stutter, has memory loss. These are all impacts, could be impacts of this hydrogen sulfide gas.
I think that the thing to realize that's new, as opposed to our old image of the small, quaint farm with a little manure being spread, is just the volume, and also what happens when you've got these huge amounts of manure that are degrading, but that the gases or the other constituents of the manure are in an indoor environment where people are working. So what happens to the workers, for example, is that they're exposed to several hundred different kinds of gases, potentially, from the degrading manure. They're exposed to toxins from the bacteria that live in the manure. They're exposed to proteins in the manure that can cause respiratory problems and allergies and asthma. And so that you see really a significant percentage of the workers who work in hog facilities, for example, having some kind of asthma or asthma-related respiratory problems.
So far, we've talked about hydrogen sulfide and nitrogen, although in large amounts, if I'm not mistaken, nitrogen can actually lead to blue baby syndrome. The technical term is methemoglobinemia.
By drinking water with nitrates in it, that can lead to blue baby syndrome. The other issue is ammonia emissions from these facilities.
There have been some public health studies that have actually associated drinking nitrate-contaminated water with certain diseases like cancers, diabetes, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So there are human health impacts that are possible from drinking the waters that are contaminated with what are called nutrients, but nutrients in excess of the land's ability to absorb them. The other problem is that there's factory farms in particular are adding things to the animal feed that were never put in feed before. And so they're putting things like antibiotics in feed routinely, or arsenic compounds, or other heavy metals. And the reason they're doing that is to kind of bypass some of the problems with infections that are created by putting so many animals in such small areas in the first place. So antibiotics, for example, are put in the feed both to make the animal grow faster, but also to keep them from getting sick from the fact that they're in a barn and stressed under stressful conditions in the first place.
Right, and the term that's used is subtherapeutic dosing. In other words, they'll get constant doses, low-level doses of these antibiotics. So,
and the problem with that from a public health standpoint is that now we have enough evidence to say that the overuse of antibiotics, which is really totally unnecessary, the overuse of antibiotics in these factory farms and in the farm environments is actually leading to drug-resistant infections that are impacting people. And some of the best information that tells us that is from Europe, where they've made a decision already to get rid of antibiotics in animal feeds just to promote the growth of animals. And what they were able to document was that when they got rid of those antibiotics in the animal feed, lo and behold, some of the drug-resistant bacteria in people started to go down, and so that those were less of a problem in the human population. In the U.S., we haven't taken those sorts of steps.
One of the things we haven't discussed so far is bacterial contamination that ultimately could affect people.
Right.
And apparently in Wisconsin, there was a major event in 1993, an infectious outbreak, and I was wondering if you could describe that.
Sure. The largest waterborne disease outbreak in the U.S. happened in Milwaukee in 1993, and it wasn't a bacteria, actually. It was something called Cryptosporidium, and over 400,000 people got sick, and they were pretty sick with things like diarrhea and cramps and fever and vomiting. And this was especially a problem with people whose immune systems were already depressed, like people with HIV/AIDS or elderly people. And 54 of them died from that outbreak. And when they went back to look for possible causes, what they identified was the manure runoff from feedlots along the rivers that form the Milwaukee's water supply. A similar thing happened in Walkerton, Ontario, more recently, where several thousand people developed infections with two different kinds of bacteria, E. coli and Campylobacter, and seven people ended up dying. And again, this was traced to farms upstream of the city's water supply. And so you're right that the bacteria from the farm environment can affect much larger populations.
Right. Campylobacter can survive for 176 days in cool water. So this is something that we're concerned about in my state, where I live next to one of the largest dairies in the state of Illinois that spilled between 2 and 10 million gallons of raw manure. And it flowed downriver to the Illinois River, and a source of drinking water for Peoria, Illinois, Peak in Illinois.
I mentioned that a lot of these facilities are putting antibiotics in the feed that's given to the animals, and one of the spin-off effects of that is that you may increase the contamination with the meat from those animals with drug-resistant bacteria. So there have been studies, for example, that have gone out where the researchers have gone out to grocery stores and bought retail chicken and then tested it for drug-resistant bacteria. And their finding is that a significant percentage of the chicken that they bought in the supermarkets were contaminated with bacteria that were resistant to multiple drugs, including salmonella bacteria.
In our local grocery stores in the Peoria area, there's a new campaign out. They're calling it a food safety campaign, where upon the consumer enters the grocery store and can wipe their hands with antiseptic wipes before they touch their shopping cart. Then when they're back in the meat counter area where the meats are distributed, there's another container of these antiseptic wipes. And the first time I saw this, I thought, did we have to do this 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when we'd go and purchase purchase meat items, it's gotten to the point where consumers are now being advised to wash their hands after they touch a meat, you know, a package of meat, which it's a good thing to do is to wash your hands after this, but the fact is that's the Band-Aid covering the problem. The solution is to raise animals in a sustainable way and not end up with animals that are so or meat that's so contaminated that the consumers have to disinfect their hands at the checkout lane.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Karen Hudson and Dave Willinga. And we've been discussing factory farms. And there are many impacts on public health. After the break, we'll be looking at the efforts to prevent some of the harmful impacts that this type of agriculture has brought about. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, Dave Willinga and Karen Hudson are with us, discussing a type of agriculture many of us may not be familiar with, concentrated animal feeding operations, otherwise known as factory farms. Factory farms have quietly grown in importance and are now responsible for over half the production of meat, poultry, and dairy in the United States. Unfortunately, as we learned in the first part of today's interview, these operations are associated with many environmental and public health problems due to their heavy reliance on hormones, antibiotics, and due to the great difficulty these operations have in getting rid of massive amounts of animal waste. In the second part of this interview, we'll continue our look at factory farms and discuss some of the strategies communities and consumers have used to avoid the harms to the environment and to health that these operations bring about. Now back to the interview. It's one of the things that surprises me about this issue of giving low levels of antibiotics on an ongoing basis to animals and farms is that, first of all, it's obvious that these antibiotics are not going away. That's already known that these antibiotics are either going to appear in the animal's excrement or themselves or in the bacteria that eventually contaminate local streams. Obviously, it's going to get out. And what surprises me is that in medicine, where we only use antibiotics pretty much either for very brief courses of prevention, mostly prior to surgery, or much more commonly in treating actual infections, there's been a major effort across the country and really internationally to limit antibiotic use to the extent possible and absolutely only use them when it's really necessary, just for the very purpose of preventing the evolution of resistant bacteria. And yet here we are in agriculture where they're used not even in the setting of infection. And I find this actually quite astounding. And I guess I'd like to know what efforts are being made by government entities, public health agencies, perhaps, to do something about that.
There was a study published in December of 2003 from University of Illinois concluding that agriculture is profiting from antibiotic use. The use of antibiotics in these factory farm settings increases efficiency and profits, according to this research. And who's profiting from this? We're seeing the drug manufacturers profit, industrial ag companies profit, and in the big picture, the losers are the consumers in the grocery store who have to disinfect their hands after they touch a package of meat.
The losers are patients I'm trying to treat whose infections are caused by bacteria that the existing antibiotics no longer work for.
Exactly.
They're the losers. We have bacteria in our local hospital even that we have virtually no antibiotics that are effective.
I'm struck, as you are, by this disconnect between what's going on in human medicine and what's going on in industrial agriculture in this country. In human medicine, we require a prescription to give out antibiotics. In agriculture, the vast majority of antibiotics are given out with no prescription because they're just put in antibiotic feeds that you can buy at any feed mill, even at stores. And that's not the way it is in Europe. In Europe now, as a result of legislation in the last few years, all antibiotics now have to be given by prescription in agriculture. But they say it can't be done in the U.S., so that's puzzling. But you're absolutely right that who pays from this decision that we've come to about how to use antibiotics, I think, is the patient. And some of these hospital infections that are resistant to multiple drugs actually have dropped in Europe when they've reduced the overuse of antibiotics in agriculture. So there is a link there. Now, what's being done about it in this country? I'm part of an effort to support legislation that would actually get rid of the use of human antibiotics as growth promoters for animals. And this is a bill that is present in both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. It's a bipartisan bill. More than 370 public health groups, medical groups, including the AMA, the American Public Health Association, the Academy of Pediatrics, they all endorsed this bill, but there haven't been hearings on it, and it still needs more support, especially from Republican senators and Republican congressmen.
Karen, you've used the word several times, sustainable agriculture. Is sustainable agriculture no longer economically viable?
The producers of the animals don't bear hardly any of the costs of the environmental pollution. With other industries, like a coal-fired power plant, the plant has to bear some of the costs of reducing the pollution from that industry, from burning coal. That's really not the case with raising food in an animal factory, where almost all of the environmental and public health costs are shifted onto the public and not borne by the producer.
It must be rather difficult to even estimate how large those costs might be. For instance, recently I had to treat a patient with an infection caused by a highly antibiotic-resistant bacterium. We managed to find an antibiotic that was effective, but it was extremely expensive. And obviously the companies that own these factory farms, they're not going to cough up the money to pay for that antibiotic.
One of the statements of agribusinesses, we have the cheapest, most plentiful food supply in the world here in the United States. And if you look underneath the rock, the fallout of that is disease, water quality issues, public health issues. It's a very expensive way to produce cheap food. Producing food in this manner has costs that are not recognized by agribusiness when they promote their so-called cheap food agenda.
30, 40 years ago, penicillin was a very effective treatment for pneumonia, for community-acquired pneumonia. And penicillin's been around so long that it's generic, so it's pretty cheap, maybe $10 or less for a prescription. But not many of us use penicillin anymore because the bacteria have gotten so resistant to it. Well, at the same time, penicillin has been one of the antibiotics that's been put in animal feed for the longest period of time. It's been used for 30 or 40 years. And so here we have a drug that was inexpensive, that used to be effective, and yet we were literally pouring it into the animal feeds without much thought about it. The Food and Drug Administration tried to address this contradiction back in the 1970s. They actually proposed banning the use of penicillins and tetracyclines in animal feed. And what happened is that the Congress got so much pressure from the industry that they basically told FDA to back off of their proposal, and FDA did. And ever since then, there has not been another attempt by the FDA to limit antibiotic use in animal feed.
Recently, a study was was conducted in Midwest swine operations, and they have found airborne antibiotic-resistant pathogens, including penicillin, near swine barns. But these researchers also tested the air inside of people's homes, and they found levels of staph and fungus in nearby residences, and much of the staph was antibiotic-resistant. So people may be exposed to these antibiotics through aerial transmission as well.
I'd like to know if there's been actions taken in the private sector to prevent some of this harm.
Some of the most exciting developments have been in the private sector, primarily by fast food companies and also food companies that provide food services to college campuses, company cafeterias, and the like. And I'll give you an example. Bon Appetit runs food service operations in several states, and they actually have a very progressive policy to not buy meat or poultry that's produced with growth promoter antibiotics or other antibiotics used for reasons other than treating sick animals. And this, I think, is really a model for how other companies could go about purchasing food. The consumer, too, often wants to buy meat that's not been raised on antibiotics. And so there's resources like the Eat Well Guide, which is at eatwellguide.org. And that is an online listing of more than 5,000 supermarkets, farms, and other outlets where you can buy meat produced without routine antibiotics.
Right. Our movie, The Meatrix, which you've probably seen, is a 4-minute flash animation video that we have released last year. Since then, we've had over 4 million viewers. And it gives a 4-minute quick education to anyone from child all the way to adult on what factory farming is. And at the end of this video, you can click to the Eat Well Guide, as David mentioned just now, and find food produced either without growth hormones or antibiotics or produced in a certain way. You can put your parameters in there, type in your zip code, and purchase locally grown meat from your area. You even type in how far you're willing to drive to get it. So we're trying to get this national network going, and so far it's proving to be very successful. And it's an answer to the problem that we've been talking about. Consumers can procure their own meat through this manner instead of just walking to the grocery store and thinking that's the only way they can get meat.
Returning again to the corporate sector, would I be correct in assuming that Bon Appetit and McDonald's and the other large corporate purchasers, if they didn't make this change and start avoiding buying meat fed with a lot of antibiotics, they didn't do this out of their own largesse, that they were pressured? Is that the case?
Well, let's talk about McDonald's for a second. McDonald's should really be applauded. They worked with Tyson, their primary chicken supplier, to raise the chickens that are sold to McDonald's without growth promoter antibiotics. And yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that they got some pressure from various parties to do that, but they also showed some leadership in doing it. What I find ironic is that hospitals, for example, don't apply those same criteria to their own chicken purchases. I mean, wouldn't it be great if hospitals bought chicken raised at least as well as McDonald's chickens are raised?
There's been a recent study called the Food and Farming Study conducted by Roper Public Affairs, and in the study, two-thirds of Americans say they would pay for food produced without chemicals such as pesticides, antibiotics, and hormones. People's voices are starting to be heard, and our project at GRACE is to educate people on what they need to know and what they need to ask for. And the consumer is actually a stakeholder, and every food dollar is a vote.
I'd like to return now to what we should expect of our government and what we're getting. So far, when you were describing some of the environmental and public health impacts and harms brought on by factory farming operations, it's really quite a long list. You mentioned bacteria contaminating water supplies in millions of people's wells. You mentioned molds and or nitrogen and phosphorus in huge quantities, even significant enough to cause hemoglobin to change to methemoglobin. You mentioned hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, methane, arsenic, and then antibiotics. And all we've heard in terms of government response is there was a bill to deal with the antibiotic part of the issue, and that hasn't even had hearings held on it, even though virtually every public health organization in the country is supporting it. Are there any other bills that would, first of all, that would take a more comprehensive approach and deal with some of these other harms besides antibiotics? And second is, what are the politics of this? What would it take to actually move some of this along?
You know, I think one thing that we have to do is look to states to show some leadership. And there are, you know, states are quite different in how they can approach local decisions about siting a factory farm, for example. One thing to note is that the American Public Health Association last year passed a policy that actually urges a moratorium on new factory farm construction until some of the public health questions can be answered. But nevertheless, states are making these decisions and they're using various criteria. One thing I'm particularly concerned about, though, is that there seems to be a pretty concerted effort to prevent counties and other local government authorities from making decisions that would restrict the siting of these factory farms on public health grounds.
That's what we call in the activist sector as local control. And I receive calls from all over the country as a consultant for the Grace Factory Farm Project. And time after time, the citizens that call say that certain entities are trying to take away local control or stopping any type of local input when these facilities locate, one of these being Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau supports local control for low-level nuclear waste and garbage dumps and the like, and yet turn around and say they do not support local control when 25 million gallons of raw manure will be a quarter of a mile from your home. So we've seen a very concerted effort to take away any type of local input regarding factory farms. In fact, within the last 2 or 3 months, actual brochure has been published when an activist group comes to town, protecting your community from unwanted division. This is produced by the Minnesota Farm Bureau Association. And in it, it has points that people that are proposing the installation or expansion of factory farms can use to stymie any type of local input or opposition to these public health issues. So we're seeing local control being threatened and taken away from states all over the country.
A case in Worth County, Iowa, actually is interesting because in that county, the local Board of Health put in place a health ordinance that regulated some of these factory farm decisions. And the case went all the way to the state Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court actually found that the local Board of Health could not restrict the factory farm siting decision, which is quite remarkable when the state Supreme Court decides that local communities can't make public health decisions about their local communities. I find that to be very worrisome.
Citizens are so desperate that they're are at least two cases in my state where the neighbors have approached someone installing a factory farm and actually offered them money to buy them out from to go away. It's a sad statement that that's what people are resorting to bribing these facilities to go away or not locate in their rural communities.
So to summarize the issue of government action, it sounds like the higher levels of government, state and federal government, have been acting to not permit local government entities, county or local governments, from keeping these operations out of their area.
Very much so.
And is there any counterbalance in that area? Is there any effort going on to try to limit some of the harm, that list I just mentioned of all the types of harms caused by these operations? Is there any effort at the federal or state levels to do something and prevent this?
In some cases, the answer is no. In other cases, I think it's too soon to tell. For instance, within the last couple of years, the Environmental Protection Agency said that it was going to look at some of the air emissions from the big factory dairy farms in California, but very little has been done yet, and it's too soon to tell how aggressive they'll be, although I think it's fair to say that some of us are pretty skeptical.
Right.
Another issue is around nuisance lawsuits. And basically, some state constitution would allow people to file a nuisance lawsuit if the enjoyment of their property is impinged by a neighbor's activity. And this maybe is a really interesting area to keep one's eye on, because if those nuisance rights are upheld, it might give an individual landowner some leverage to influence how a neighboring factory or a neighboring farm acts.
Right.
But again, it's a little too soon to tell if that right is going to be upheld across the country.
In our state, several groups have filed anticipatory nuisance suits even before the facility was finished or before the facility was built to try and stop them. So that's another avenue that legally that people are being forced to take.
I think the larger philosophical question is, should the burden of protecting the health of the public fall squarely on the individual, or does government have some role to make sure that the health of the citizenry stays intact? I'm afraid that we're sort of falling in the former rather than the latter.
So the bottom line is that there's no meaningful legislation at the federal level, and there's no regulatory agency such as the EPA or FDA or any other that is contemplating meaningful action. Is that what I'm understanding? And that it sounds like that's even the case at the state levels.
I think meaningful and how you define that is kind of the key. I mean, people who take a different point of view are going to point to EPA regulations under the Clean Water Act. But from my standpoint, that's looking at a piece of the problem rather than the problem, because it focuses only on some of the pollutants in water emissions from some of the facilities. And what we have laid out is that it's not just a water problem, it's an air problem, it's a worker problem, it's an antibiotic problem. And whatever steps have been taken at the federal level aren't addressing that whole range of public health issues.
One of the things that we did not talk about yet was where our money from our land-grant universities, the research, is geared towards. And we commonly see research at our universities geared towards promoting this type of animal production. We're seeing a little bit of change, but still, we need to have more research promoting sustainable agriculture. For example, there's research that shows that smaller pasture-based dairy farms are actually more efficient and more profitable than large confinement dairies. People are switching over to grazing. It's better for the animal. The quality of milk is better. It's an improved quality of life for neighbors, and the ecological impact is phenomenal as far as managed grazing. So there's pluses all the way around, and this is one of the things we're focusing on, is that there is a sustainable way to produce animals and meat and milk in the United States, and we need to focus on making more funding go towards farmers who are willing to embrace that type of animal production.
I guess I'd like to wrap up by asking you, first of all, if you can recommend websites where interested listeners could learn more about this whole issue of sustainable agriculture. And the other question is, the two ways you might be impacted are by what you're eating, and then if some listeners may have a factory farm that's trying to develop in their area, and so they might want help in how to respond to that. Is there any set of actions or model for how other communities have responded to the threat or the problems caused by a factory farm?
At the Grace Factory Farm Project website, which is factoryfarm.org, again, that's factoryfarm.org. We have put together a comprehensive guide in how to approach this issue if a factory farm is expanding or located in a rural community. And I am the person who folks will first speak to at the Grace Factory Farm Project regarding this. And then we have consultants that are based all over the country, even in Canada, that are there to help organize and provide facts. And one of our goals during this organizing is facts. We try and provide university peer-reviewed studies and actual facts about the issue that citizens can utilize with their local legislators and media. Factoryfarming.org will also link you to the Metrics, which is our four-minute flash animation video, which educates the public on what the industrial food system is, what it's costing us, and at the end of that, we have solutions. And you click on the solutions, and there you go, you've got those. So there's quite a bit of action you can take.
The consumer and the questions they ask of the supermarkets, of the meat department at the supermarkets, of restaurants, of school districts are incredibly important. For example, school districts, I think, feel compelled in many cases to buy the cheapest quality meat. And people, as parents, need to start asking questions about what that means. Are the meats and the dairy products being served in the schools? What are the conditions that they're being raised under? Are the animals being given routine antibiotics? Are they being given, are chicken that's served, is it being raised with arsenic compounds? Is the milk being raised using hormones? All these are valid questions and questions that people should be asking, not only of the schools, but of the meat counter at their supermarkets. And, you know, supermarkets operate on a very small margin and are incredibly responsive to their customers. So those questions will get the supermarkets asking the right questions and so on and so on. The website for my program is www.iatp.org/food and health. And what you'll find there is kind of a look at a whole slew of the issues that we've touched on related to food production, but also many scientifically referenced fact sheets that have some of the sources for public health science, so that if your listeners are public health professionals themselves, they can see where some of these see where some more sources of information are about these issues. And want to mention again the Eat Well Guide, www.eatwellguide.org.
Well, Karen Hudson and Dave Willinga, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I was glad to be a part of the program. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.